Accession number 28650, Mr. Gordon Mellor, Reel 12. Now, we're talking about the main briefing. Now, we've had the reaction, which was a sort of shocked reaction, or you know, a hooray, cheers to the reaction, the big raid. Now, what would the next bit be? I mean, how detailed would the specialist briefings be? You'd had your specialist briefing, but, you know.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm not sure whether anybody else had had a particular briefing or not, but I don't think so. I'm not sure of the order. It didn't necessarily follow, but we had the a signals leader, and he would give his particular instructions to the wireless operators. You would have the bombing leader, and he would describe the bomb load, whether it was HE or whether there was fire-raising bombs or what else you would carry. If on some places, of course, then you could carry a 4,000-pounder or more. This was given in detail so that whoever was going to drop the bombs had knew why you had to drop them in a certain order.
Now, do you remember you were dropping incendiaries this time, from the looks of things?
I think we were mainly on incendiaries, yes. We were the fire-raising, part of the fire-raising section of the raid.
Now, so what else? Anything else about the main briefing? Or?
Each one had his particular instructions to his particular specialty in the crew. And we would then get the weatherman, meteorologist, stand up, and sometimes he would get a cheer, sometimes he wouldn't. But certainly he gave us information about the conditions going out to the target, what we should expect if we were going to pass through a front or something, and then we were all into one. And also where we could expect clear weather or where we could expect low or high cloud, setting of the moon and the like, and also the conditions for return as to whether we're likely to get fog at back at base, or whether we, if we got back by a certain time thereabouts, whether we should escape it and fog would come down afterwards. In other words, to sort of get back and not dally around too much. Because it tends to come on in the early hours of the morning when temperatures drop quite a bit and fog starts to form. We also had information on the beacons, which were visual beacons, which were scattered about the country.
Now, what are these?
From the flying position, they were just flashing lights, but they flashed usually two letters. You had the code for that. If you were a bit unsure of your position, you saw a beacon over to the right, and you read the letters, and you really should be flying very close to it, and it gave you the clue that you better alter course. We also had what the colours of the day were. Now, these were cartridges to put in the very pistol, which was locked in position in the roof of the aircraft. And we had the colours of the day for this country, and we had the colours of the day for flying over the continent. And they changed each day, whether greens or reds and yellows and certain combinations. If you were under attack, then you could puff off required cartridge colours to try and sort of make the bloke think and give you a few more seconds of to get away from them. But that was the sum total. There was a summing up usually by the CO, wing commander, the group captain would give you some encouragement to press on, and in some cases, Constantine, the group captain, actually came on the raids. He used to usually fly with one navigator by the name of Spiller, Dizzy Spiller, great friend of mine, and Dizzy was renowned for the minimum equipment he used to use with carrying his carrying out his job as a navigator.
Might come back to him. What about Constantine? He's the group captain.
Yes.
What was he like? I mean, that's Hugh Constantine, isn't it?
Yeah. Group captain. Yeah. Yeah.
He'd be the man who'd give you an address or possibly fly. What was he like? What impression did he make on you?
Yes, reassuring man he was. He was a man of considerable experience. The camp revolved around him. There's no doubt about that. People thought a great deal of him. I've met him since at reunions. He's dead now, of course, but in the 1990s he used to be up at the reunion. I met him two or three times, and he was a very affable man.
You obviously had confidence in him during the, you know.
Sure. Oh, yes. Yes, one did. Especially when he, because he came on the first 1,000 raid with us. I'm not sure who he flew with, but he went as a pilot. I suspect that he acted as second pilot for a good part of it. I'm not sure whether he acted as the first pilot, but he certainly was there.
He was taking the risks with you.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Now, so anything else about the briefing? You'd have a speech from, you know, to him or whatever?
A pep talk, so to speak. Don't want anybody sort of doing this, that or the other thing, like sort of hanging about and coming back, getting back too late in view of the weather conditions which are expected. Press on. It's up to the captain to decide whether your aircraft is unfit you have to turn around and come back, or what the circumstances were. But generally it was to press the home the attack. And that was it. And then if there was time, we would go and have a meal in the mess.
Was it a special meal, like the crew breakfast, or was it just an ordinary meal?
No, I think... if there were eggs around, then they were made available then. it was a good meal.
Would you eat before? Did you want to? Some people didn't eat because they were nervous. Or did you eat before?
Oh, I did. I was greedy. Yes, I had a good appetite, I must admit.
Now, when would you put your flying kit on?
Oh, we were down at the crew, at the flights.
After the crew meal, then what then? Sorry.
Oh, well, after the meal, you knew what time you had to be ready go out to the aircraft, and you had to be there beforehand, with all your gear, and for a possible last few comments from the CO.
So where would you go?
That would be the wing commander.
Where would you go during this interval?
Back to your quarters. In our case, early on, it's a Nissen hut. It's very likely where all your gear was there.
Your flying kit was there.
Yeah. Oh yes, it was all there.
Now, what did you wear on, say, that raid in these early days? What was your flying kit for a Wellington?
Same as we had worn in Canada. There was a SIG cut suit, I think it was called. If the weather was reasonable. Other times, and of course we had the leather jacket with the lamb's wool or the wool sort of lining, and it was about as long as the battle dress tunic. It came down, you know, just almost to your hips, I suppose, and it got fur collar and trousers, be your normal second best or whatever it was, and if you had two lots, working trousers anyhow. There was a leather and furry trouser arrangement available. I think mine stayed in the kit bag or in my wherever I stored my gear for quite some time. We eventually did get lockers, but I got a feeling to start with we had to make do with our kit beds in the living quarters. But the lockers would have been down in the flights.
So would you go from your down to... Did you have a flight office?
Oh, yes.
We haven't talked about it.
That's where the wing... where you went...
that's where the briefing was.
Close by. Yes, close by. But when we first arrived and went on that first morning to see the squadron CO, that was in the flights, the flight office. Where the lockers were, and the adjutant, squadron adjutant, had an office. The various squadron leaders had rooms and or offices to work from. The nav leader had one, the bombing leader had one, and so did the radio people. And there was a general crew room.
And what was the crew room like?
Well, it was a big room, and in particular case, there was a big table in the middle, and it was covered with linoleum. When I say big, it was big, and there was a lip all the way round. Now, its function was, if you were getting additional information, you could use it, put your charts on it, and make an alteration or some whatever you're necessary, or write down a note. But it was also used as a game we used to play. It wasn't Shove Hapley proper, but it was a game with coins which we used to flick from one end of the table to the other, sort of a tabletop bowls. And it was more or less on that sort of line. Whether any other squadron had did it or not, I don't know. It's just that we had the table, which was kept smooth and clear for that sort of a general relief, I suppose, or to while away the time while you were waiting for something to happen.
Now, when the time came, you'd leave the flight, the crew room, would you? Where would you go?
Oh, we'd just go outside, and the motor transport people would then have... whatever sort of vehicles they used there. Some were lorries, sometimes there was a mini coach and the like, and you would be get on board as a crew with all your junk gear, and you would say which site of the aircraft, either by number or by the dispersal point, or by the number, the letter of the aircraft. And the mostly the WAS were driving the transports, and they would take you out as a crew and leave you at the dispersal point with the aircraft waiting, where your ground crew also would be evident.
Now, what about your relationship with the ground crew? What did the ground crew do for you, and how did you appreciate it, and do you know what I mean?
Yes, I think we did. The ground crew was responsible for keeping the apparatus flying. They did all the tests and the maintenance work that was necessary, and they worked under a corporal, and also it was a sergeant or flight sergeant who supervised them. There was generally a flight sergeant who would supervise all the ground crew in the one flight, which could be 9 aircraft, I suppose. And yes, our lives were in their hands, so they sort of kept the aircraft on top line so that it performed as it was supposed to for 5, 6, 7 hours, however long you were flying.
So you had confidence in them.
Oh, you had to. Yes, you had to. Yes.
Now, what happened? You got to your plane. It's in its dispersal point, obviously. Now, what happens first when you get to the aircraft? I mean, were there any final checks, or would you?
Oh well, the gunners would already have fitted their particular guns into the rear turret. That'd been done earlier on, He didn't have to carry all that out. Navigator had to carry his gear with him, so that was no problem. And the pilots would get up into the aircraft and confer with the senior ground staff man there just about what they'd found out, what had been done about it from previous flying. And eventually, if that was all sorted out, then they would start up engines. In the meantime, the rest of the crew was probably outside, having got their gear stowed away, and those who wanted a last smoke were smoking their final cigarette. Anyhow, as soon as they were going to switch on.
Hang on, did you have any superstitions? Because some crews were superstitious, some weren't. Some used to urinate on the back wheel, or others used to have...
Oh, I've heard about that.
Did you have any superstitions in that crew that you can recall?
I used to wear the same scarf every time. Every flight I did, I wore the same scarf. Got a bit battered. It was a blue one with white spots on it, which was... the in thing in the 1938, 6, 7, 8 or something like that. Anyhow, I wore that.
Did that matter to you?
Yeah, it did to a certain extent. It was a routine. I made sure I got it with me every time. So that I put it on when I got dressed, and that, but it stayed there until one got back and got rid of your flying gear.
But that was your only superstition?
My future wife gave me a St. Christopher silver one, which she bought. You wear it, you know, if you want to, you wear it, or you can't, whichever you want to do. So, I saw it. She had given that to me when we were at Lichfield, I think pretty well all the time I flew in this country. I sort of got it slung around my neck with my dog tags.
Now, so you got into the aircraft.
Yeah.
What's next?
I would have, in the previous 20 minutes, I would have already got my gear out. The charts on the table. I had a place where I put my topographical map, so I wanted to do any map reading at any time, and to a hand. On those first trips, we hadn't got G-Box on, there was no need to mess around with that. The astrograph, I made sure that it came on and off, and it was at the right height, and it was level with the table. You had a two-piece wood rod. It screwed together, and the astrograph had to be that set height above your chart. And you'd try all four corners of the to make sure it was all level.
Now, just to make clear, you had no other, sort of beams or rays or any sort of wireless beacons or anything that you at this time.
No, the radio beacons and what have you. That was the responsibility of the radio operator. So
they weren't your responsibility.
No, not mine. No, but he. Would if he got bearings off with the loop aerial, which was erected on the spine of the aircraft, usually he would pick up bearings now and again. But it was it became a sort of a routine that he would try and get me some bearings at intervals during the flight.
That's just to check what you were doing.
Well, it gives you. If you've got a bearing like that, you knew, and put it on the chart, you knew that at that moment of time, then you were somewhere along that line. It wouldn't give you a fix. But if it was at right angle to your route, then it would be a check on ground speed. Could you see how far you were going along? It was one of the aids.
Any other aids? Or is that...
No, at that time, it was pretty simple.
Now, so you're getting your maps and your astrograph ready.
Yeah.
Anything else?
make sure I got my parachute in the right place.
Now, where would you put that's interesting. Where would you put your parachute?
Oh, there was a bucket, a square bucket arrangement where you put your own parachute there. The rest of the crew all got their spare. They've got their places for putting their parachutes, all close by to their actual operative positions.
Is the next thing any last minute checks before takeoff, or is it takeoff the next thing?
Oh no, I would have a go at the Astrodome, make sure it'd come undone. That was about the last thing I think I did. In the meantime, of course, the pilot would have started up engines and run them up to the required amount and flicked his various switches, and if everything was okay, then he would sign the requisite form. Now, what was it? 200? I don't know. I can't remember. But it was a form which was produced by the ground crew, and it's signed to the fact that he'd tested what he could of the aircraft, the engines and the like, and it was to his satisfaction that he was taking the responsibility of the aircraft from them. So this was done on every flight.
So what was the takeoff routine then after he'd signed that?
Well, we'd been given times for takeoff, and as soon as you heard the first aircraft, the first one off, as soon as they started their engines up, then of course it gave the signal to the others, and they'd all the way around the airfield you'd hear engines starting up. And the routine going through. When the first one was given instructions to take off, then the rest of you got it onto the perimeter track, and you then sort of taxied round to the takeoff end of the runway in question, depending on the direction of the wind, and. In many cases, the perimeter track cut across the runway so that to gain the extra space, you actually sort of went along towards the end and then turned around, so you got the maximum length, even though you had to go across the perimeter track to during your takeoff. And you queued up and you got to your point and you waited for a signal from the control tower. And the crew would be sitting in specified positions.
Now, what were they?
The pilots were obviously in the right place. The rest of us would be back in the fuselage. So if there was any accident, then there weren't any people in the turrets. Mm. Once you were airborne, then... this was the same procedure followed in the OTU. Then the rear gunner, the front gunner, the wireless operator, navigator all went to their own particular points of working. I'd get the front gunner into the front turret and shut the bulkhead door. And the pilots had already got my first course. So we took off. Circle ground, gaining height all the time, and go across the centre of the runway, and you'd say, right, we're off now, or words to that effect, and we'd be over the centre of the runway, of the airfield, to all intents and purposes, and I'd note the time down, and that everything sprang from that time forward.
Now, it's important for people to realise that you were flying individually within a bomber stream. You weren't in formation. That's what people have to grasp. You were on your own.
That's right.
With aircraft all around you, plotting their own courses.
Yes.
Could you just talk? Was it difficult to fly within a bomber stream? I mean, could you see other aircraft or what? You know.
Not really.
I know it's night.
Yeah. No. Not really. I mean, the aircraft. There was a certain glow inside. The pilots had to have a certain amount of the instruments lit so they could maintain a steady course direction or a steady airspeed. They sort of had to see that they were flying as economically as they could do to get there in the time required. The navigator gave them the speeds they wanted to be flown to, depending on the time where you were and the time of you're over the target. The navigator had an anchor poise lamp, something, you know, on that style thing, but with a bigger hood. You needed a good light to plot all the information that was coming into you, and sort of keep an eye on the time and how close you were getting to the next turning point.
Was there a risk of collision in a bomber stream?
Yes, I suppose there was. You're all going the same way, mind you. That was one of the main reasons why you didn't come back on the same route, because in the early days, and especially on this 1,000 bomber raid, it was probably a 90-minute raid. Well, you were part of the way home when some of the last people were still approaching the target. So you weren't flying against each other. You were kept well away.
Now, what was your routine during the flight? What were you doing?
Well, my main object, was to calculate the winds that were affecting us. So that's why much as possible you wanted information from the outside. It's the best that you can get, so that you went across from Elsham, you had a point at which you had to leave the coast, so you made sure you knew exactly where you crossed the coast and the time, and from that you plot that on your chart, and if it didn't coincide to the actual track that you were supposed to be making, then of course you had to calculate a revision. I don't suppose one was worried about the mile, but you tried to keep to the required track as close as possible.
Was there any means of working out the wind speed from within there?
You've got some of the, you're back to the old triangle of velocities again. You've got your own heading, which was your course. You've got your airspeed, and you'd got your track from when you left the aerodrome to the point you crossed the coast. You could measure that distance. You'd also had taken the time, so you could calculate your speed, and you plotted those out, and the distance between those two points that you plotted gave you your wind speed and direction, so you then compared it with the winds which have been given to you by the Metop people, and if it made a considerable difference, then it would indicate that they were not true winds that they'd expressed to you, and you would then apply that to any other winds further up, that correction, and try to sort of get back to your original track.
Anything else you'd be doing other than this sort of constant monitoring?
No, well, the monitoring was the main point. You really had to know where you were for the greater part of the journey. Not every minute or so, you would check your progress as much as possible, because you've got to keep to the timing of the raid. And if you were given a certain time, then for the raid to be effective as a whole, then you had to be there on your squadron's time schedule. So on occasions, then you had to decide what to do. If the wind behind you was stronger and you were making up time, you're going to be there early, and it's no good getting there early before anybody else. So you then had to sort of slow down a bit. Or you did a dogleg. You sort of went out at 60 degrees for so many minutes, and then back again 60 degrees, an isosceles triangle. So in actual fact, it took twice as long as it would have done if you had gone straight along. Or if you were behind time, you'd ask the pilot to put up a bit extra speed.